The world is going through changes. Changes happening at a speed that we have never seen before. This is leading to disruption, chaos, panic, fear, hysteria, and a turbulent economy and marketplace. How do you protect your wealth in a turbulent world? How do you invest for cash flow and alternative assets to escape the rat race in times of uncertainty? How do you decentralize yourself, your family, your community, your business, and your investments to become sovereign and escape the matrix? If you are looking for strategies, tactics, and techniques to escape the rat race and matrix, you are in the right place. My name is MC Lobsher, and this is Cashflow Ninja. This is Cashflow Ninja. I'm MC Lobsher. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode and spending the most valuable resource, your time, once again with me. Everything Cashflow Ninja is at CashflowNinja.com, CashflowNinja.com. You can find all three of my podcasts at CashflowNinja.com, Cashflow Ninja, Cashflow Investing Secrets, and Reset Investing Secrets. You can grab a copy of my book, The 21 Best Cashflow Niches. You can subscribe to my newsletter, The Best Cashflow Niches Newsletter, in which I share one brand new, well-researched cashflow niche every single month with my subscribers. And you can join my mastermind, Cashflow Nirvana, which was built for business owners and investors looking to protect and build wealth during turbulent times. Everything at CashflowNinja.com. I've got a fantastic show for you today. I'm joined by Alex Craner. He is an authority when it comes to following trends in the investment world. And he brings a very, very unique and interesting perspective when it comes to geopolitical matters as well. I'm very excited to have Alex on the show. Alex, great to see you.
Great to see you, MC. Good to have, thank you for your invitation and good to join you.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this conversation. Now, for my listeners and my viewers out there that's not familiar with Alex Craner, you and what you do and what you're up to these days, can you please share a little bit about just your background, your journey, and what you get up to these days?
Sure. So I'm a former hedge fund manager and author. I publish a newsletter at Substack. I'm active on Twitter. I'm a trend follower by conviction and by practice, and I publish a daily trend following newsletter, and I also consult a number of investment advisors and hedge fund organizations on trend following strategies. So that's, you know, me in a nutshell, professionally, personally, you know, could be here forever.
And you're based out of Europe, right? So your background, you're from Croatia. Yes. Where are you based out of predominantly, and you travel quite a bit as well?
Well, a little bit, yes, but I'm based out of Monaco, but I'm a Croatian originally, so I would say I go back and forth between Monaco and Croatia, but the residence, the home base is Monaco now for the last 26 years.
Okay, and what do you like about Monaco? What has that experience been living there?
Oh, gee, you know, like if you asked me this before the pandemic, I would have told you that it's the best place in the world in my experience. And I've lived in many different places. You know, I lived in South America, in the United States, Switzerland, UK, a few European countries and so forth. Monaco is just a very well-ordered principality. It's clean, it's safe, it's very convenient. You know, dealing with the local administration is generally easy and painless. There's no tax on personal income. Taxes on corporate income are relatively low, and you know, like if you go by the book, they're not that low. But generally, you know, it's all paid almost on a negotiated basis, and generally what you find out, that if you pay between 5 and 7% taxes, that's, you know, like you're good, you're in good standing. And so, you know, I like that it's by the sea. It's kind of cosmopolitan, yet relatively small. It's safe and clean. Schools are good. Healthcare is good. You know, children, you know, my children from the age of 6 pretty much were free range. I didn't have to worry about where they are. They learn how to get on the bus, go to school, come back, all of those things, which in most places you cannot do anymore. You know, parents drive their children everywhere, wait for them, pick them up, you know, which is fine. But, you know, the way I grew up, the normal thing is that somewhere around the age of 6, 7, you start roaming everywhere by yourself. And so in Monaco, this is still preserved. So I really appreciated that.
Awesome. Awesome. And then your career in hedge funds, and was there any particular sector? Like, can you share a little bit about that experience and how you applied your trend following skills there?
Yeah. So I, you know, my professional background goes to oil trading, physical, you know, like the cargoes on tankers. And from that, I kind of transitioned into the hedge fund industry. Because my, you know, like I worked as a market analyst, and then my company, which was a Swiss-based commodity trading firm, they asked me to look into the risk from price exposure, right? And so I worked with a team of software analysts and analysts and software programmers, and we just kind of not randomly, but let's say that not knowing about trend following, we are thinking about over about 2-3 years converged on trend following, right? Because we started from the classical, you know, supply demand fundamentals analysis and so forth. And very quickly, we found that we didn't really have any kind of an edge, that we, you know, could not base real-time decision making on fundamentals analysis for a whole host of reasons. Yet we noticed, you know, by, you know, looking at all these markets every day and looking at how prices fluctuated, we just kind of, it dawned on us, well, you know, it seems that markets are just kind of moving in trends, whatever we think about it. And these trends always end up going way beyond what we think is, quote unquote, justified. So I thought, like, well, like, let's look into trends, how we can exploit these trends and capture value from them. And that's how we began developing a trend following model, just by kind of working out how to try to extract value from trends and then not get killed when there are no trends. And then once we designed the prototype, it was very clear that we were not shackled to the oil industry, that once we knew how to navigate price trends, then we could trade soybeans and coffee and cocoa and, you know, stock indices and treasuries, anything really. And then I started pushing inside the company. I said, like, hey, you know, like maybe we should be expanding into the hedge fund industry. And, but, you know, like my superior, there were just guys who were in oil trading for 30 years. They started in 1970s and they were like, yeah, whatever, if you want to do that, the door's open. And you know, I was in my early 30s. I was long on ambition and short on caution. And I was like, all right, I'm out of here. But I managed to claw my way in little by little, and I was able to stay in the industry for about 15 years. I didn't survive the pandemic. Yeah. But I, because my whole concept is based on a software technology that codifies my trading model, I was able to leverage this technology in different ways. So, you know, I generate a daily CTA trend following newsletter, and I also provide the turnkey portfolio solutions for other investment managers. And so, you know, so far so good. That's my daily bread and butter. And then I've also kind of become quite active writing and speaking, because one of the things that has kind of evolved over these years is that world has come to the verge of a World War III. Yeah. And I've been very concerned about this for the last, I should say, 10 years at least. And I thought that if that happens, then most of these other things that we're worried about on the daily basis are not going to matter all that much. So I kind of felt compelled to start writing about these things to try to, let's say, to try to add my voice to preservation of peace and prevention of a world war breaking out. And I thought, whatever, you know, I'm just one voice, but I need to be able to do what I can. And maybe, you know, by virtue of 1,000 cuts, maybe we can kill the war drive. And if I can put my cut in there, then, you know, I've done something with my life.
Yep. And that's a massive trend too, right? That trend, and you're saying you kind of have seen this over the last 10 years. So this trend has been, It was born, you could see it. I mean, we saw all the shenanigans that happened in 2014 in the Ukraine. A lot of people only think that it just recently started, but this has been a decade basically of this trend accelerating, right? And now it's picking up steam and it's now on a collision course basically, unless there's a trend reversal.
Yeah, correct. This has been building up for a long time before it became noticeable. And the way I kind of picked it up, well, you know, there was the war in Georgia in 2006, then there was a coup in Ukraine in 2014. But I also, you know, I came in touch with some people in the hedge fund industry, notably Bill Browder, who, you know, I ran into him a few times. And he was one of these exponents of the Western, let's call it, a network of interests who are clearly pushing for this great confrontation with Russia that obviously had the potential to evolve into World War III. And in 2015, he published his book called Red Notice. It became a bestseller because it was shadow. The shadow writer behind him was Lee Child. And so it's a devilishly well-written book, except that the whole narrative is a lie. It's a fraudulent narrative, except that they use that very narrative to lobby through U.S. Congress the so-called Magnitsky Act in December of 2012. And that law, which is an abomination for Western legal standards, but that law was deemed to be the opening salvo of the new Cold War between the United States and Russia. And that relationship is very, very critical to preserving peace. And so I thought, my God, somebody needs to, you know, unmask these people, except, you know, I thought I probably knew more about that than the average person. So I thought, okay, well, may as well be me. Well, you know, I must have hit the wire because 5 weeks after the book was published, it also got banned. So, you know, I got something there right.
And what was your book called again? The one that was
the first edition in 2017 was called The Killing of William Browder.
Okay.
And then it got banned 5 weeks after I published it. I self-published it on Amazon, right? Mm-hmm. And then a company called Red Pill Press approached me, and they proposed to republish the book. They spent the next 9 months combing through the text to make sure that there's nothing that they could get sued for, and that everything is, you know, everything adds up, everything is backed up with, you know, with documentary evidence and so forth. And then we also changed the title because we thought also, well, maybe the title Killing of William Browder could also be problematic. So we changed it to Grand Deception. And then they republished it. 6 weeks later, it got banned again. So it wasn't the title. it was something else. But, you know, apparently I was onto something because I'm not a, you know, I'm not a best-selling author. I don't have great visibility and all this. So I'm not necessarily a great threat to these structures of power. But, you know, the fact that they went out of their way to ban my book means that something I wrote in there is rubbing them the wrong way.
I want to take a moment to share something very important right now. Are you trying to figure out how to protect your savings from the banking collapse, which has already started, and the coming financial crisis? Most banks will fail. Deposits that are not insured by the FDIC will be lost, and there will be bank bail-ins. And this collapse in the banking system will lead to chaos in the financial system. Banks also provide loans to real estate investors. So what do you think is going to happen to lending in the event of a banking and a financial crisis? You can be proactive and position your savings to protect it and also have access to it to use it to buy discounted assets by positioning it in your own banking system through the infinite banking concept strategy. Producers Wealth has put together a presentation at yourownbankingsystem.com where you will learn how to position capital outside of the banking system and the Wall Street casino, just like the ultra wealthy, to protect it and create a pool of tax-free liquid capital to capitalize on the massive opportunity to buy discounted assets, which is coming. You can access the presentation at yourownbankingsystem.com. That's yourownbankingsystem.com. What for folks that is not familiar, what is it about? It's the Magnitsky Act. What is it about that set up this new kind of Cold War? Because now we're 12 years later, you know, off the mat almost. So what was it about that act that you saw that you said, wow, this is setting the stage now for a massive confrontation here?
Well, you know, I first set out to, let's say, unmask the deception in Bill Browder's narrative. And so first two chapters are almost entirely devoted to his own narrative, and I kind of debunk it in his own words, because, you know, if you pay close attention to his narrative, you see that there are so many contradictions and incoherences in it that if you say, like, look, he says this and then he says this, it can't be, both cannot be true. So it's dead easy to debunk it this way. But, you know, as I was doing research to the background of all these events, I realized that there was a massive rabbit hole. And the more I went into it, the more fascinating and the bigger the thing became. And so it's not just him. It's like this historical context to the relationship between Russia and the West, which stretches back at least two centuries. And it's essentially the same interest groups that are constantly scheming to try to basically turn Russia into a their own colony.
Yep.
Balkanize it and turn it into a colony, like whatever, like Congo, like any nation of the global south that's been plundered and exploited for the last several centuries. That's what they wanted to do with Russia, except for some reason it's never working according to their plans and schemes, because Russia actually has a certain robust cultural and civilizational immune capabilities. And so even when their schemes are successful, eventually they get shaken out, and eventually Russia rises back up, which is what we're observing now again.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see. And to your point with all these interest groups, there was recently a I think it was in the past week, an interview published by the Belarusian president that was interviewed. And I mean, he made no bones about exactly what was going on. And he kicked, I mean, the one of the first things that he started to do that the media was actually criticizing him, which he like took as a badge of honor, was kicking out all of the NGO groups, right? All of these foundations that are coming in with all of their money for these interest groups. And these are eventually the folks that, I mean, it's the same playbook they used in the Ukraine that came in and eventually fomented the coup d'etat there, which they wanted to do with him. But he saw it play out in a country very close to him, and he was prepared for this. So, you know, it's more and more, it's interesting to see that the, I mean, the countries like Belarus and Russia, they know the game, they understand what's going on. So they're kind of, putting things in place to protect themselves, right?
Yes, exactly. And I, so, yeah, the playbook is now very well understood. You know, they ran the, you know, the Rose Revolution in Georgia in 2003, and then the Orange Revolution in 2004 in Ukraine, and then again the coup in 2014. And they've done this in so many countries that by now the technology is very well understood. It relies heavily on these, I think we're always talking about hundreds of NGOs in any given country.
Yep.
Each one, you know, funded, each one kind of ideologized to be, you know, to think that the light comes from the West, to be susceptible to Western ideas, Western ideology. And then at a given moment when, you know, like some crisis event happens, and usually it's contested elections. And elections are contested almost systematically because this whole idea with exit polls, you know, that's part of this technology, you know. So they will have elections, and then these Western NGOs will also run the exit polls. And then if the candidate they don't like happens to win the election, then they will come out and say like, hey, you know, our exit poll says something else, so the election must have been fraudulent. Then they encourage like thousands of people to flood into the streets and protest, right? And then usually when people are out on the streets, then that's the opportunity to fan out the destructive elements, the provocateurs, the people who will come with weapons and who are ready to occupy government buildings, presidential palaces, the parliaments and so forth, police headquarters. And that's how you run, color revolutions and coups. And I think that by now, you know, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Russia, China, they all understand the game and they all understand where the danger is coming from. So that same technology no longer works, you know. And so now what do? You try war, you try assassination. But I think it's getting more and more difficult for the West to be effective and successful with what they've been doing for so long.
Where do you think this, because this is a huge trend, like you said, I mean, you could focus on a variety of trends, but this is a pretty big one because the others might not have, it really matter if this one plays out. What do you think, where's this all headed? And also your thoughts, if you have any, on, you know, just current events in Russia, in the Ukraine, the war, and then, you know, kind of this kind of it's not even a cold war really anymore between NATO and Russia. It's actually looks pretty hot already. Yes. It's just not openly I would say admitted, right?
Well, MC, I think that we are at one of the probably biggest junctures in history at present. You know, it's not just a small thing that Russia might prevail in Ukraine, which by now looks all but inevitable, you know. It's that we may be at the end of one of the largest and longest running social experiments ever. You know, we had, okay, I like to go always back to the statement that George Soros said in his 2021 address to the Davos gathering in May. And he said that what we're witnessing is a clash of two models of governance. Yeah. And yep. I think that that sets the biggest, the broadest context to what we're seeing now. One of the governance models that he's talking about is the Western imperial colonial model of governance. And the other one is, you know, pretty much the rest of humanity, because today it may be led by Russia and China as the dominant powers, or let's say dominant powers that are independent of this Western matrix. But essentially, it's any other model of governance. And the imperial colonial Western model of governance has been dominant for now, I would say, at least 3, 4, maybe 5 centuries.
Yep.
And I think that we're coming to a point of discontinuity where this model of governance is really in jeopardy, and it might completely collapse because it's been seen through and because it has been so drastically pathogenic and destructive to the whole rest of the world, that the very fact that it's now weakened, that there's credible opposition, and then there's growing understanding of the way this model works, that I think that people are done with it. You know, like, we have ended 6 major indigenous civilizations around the world in these last 5 centuries. You know, the 3 South American civilization, China, India, and Japan. Yep. And we have destroyed literally thousands of, you know, smaller cultures, kingdoms, tribes, and so on. And we've depopulated huge swathes of native populations around the world. This is pretty unique in history. You know, we've had empires before, we had you know, conquests before, but we've never had anything quite as destructive as at this scale. And we are still today living the continuity of this system, except I think that there's a good chance that it's come to a wall, and that behind the leadership of Russia and China, there's a real, genuine opportunity to end this once for all.
Yeah, it definitely is. It's very interesting to see this. This will play out. I want to take a moment to recognize one of our sponsors, Penumbra Solutions. Life Settlements investments have allowed financial and banking institutions to not only buy their equity contractually, but also diversify their capital from any economic, market, and geopolitical risk. It's been part of the $1 billion blueprint followed by institutional investors. If you're an accredited investor, you can also now participate in this vehicle with enormous growth potential. You can watch an informational webinar presented by one of the premier organizations providing life settlement investments, Penumbra Solutions, at cashflowninja.com/life settlements. That's cashflowninja.com/life settlements. The password to access that webinar is Penumbra, all lowercase. Switching a little bit gears on the investment side, because we've got a lot of folks that see the same thing. So there's a lot of uncertainty. You could see this trend accelerating, which is a very, very dangerous trend. I don't think people understand how dangerous it is. In a world such as this, which is going to create a lot of turbulence, if this trend follows through, what are some of the trends that you're seeing from a freedom-seeking wealth builder perspective that folks might be able to first protect capital and in other ways multiply capital during these times?
I think that almost inevitably we're going to see a rise of inflation, and we've already seen it in 2021, 2022. Now we are in a stage of disinflation, which is also normal. You know, like when you look at inflations through history, U.S. inflations in the late 1940s and early 1950s, and then the inflation in 1970s, they both went in three large waves. You know, it is entirely possible that we're going to see inflation in three waves again, or more. Who knows? But you know, I don't think that we're beyond inflation. I think that inflation is still very much here. It could span the next 10 years or more, which would also be pretty normal to expect. I think it's going to engulf pretty much most of the developed nations. I think that the consequence of this is that the purchasing power of currencies like dollar, euro, pound, yen are going to deteriorate dramatically. And I think that this is obviously going to lead to large-scale repricing of commodities, and so this is kind of consistent with the you know, empirical fact that the best hedge against inflation is exposure to commodity futures, and also it's consistent with the commodity supercycle scenario, which you know is also pretty much widely anticipated. And I think that there's a chance that, okay, so, you know, the commodity super cycle, I don't know, maybe your viewers and listeners have seen, somebody has produced a chart going back 150 years, I think to 1850s more or less, where you see these large cycles of commodity prices relative to equity prices. Right. So you see at some point that commodities are priced relatively high relative to equities, and then they decline over long periods of time, and then commodities are priced low relative to equities. I think that 2 years ago, we passed pretty much the 50-year low of, you know, equity prices were very high, commodity prices were very low. And then we had over the last 2 years of fairly strong way of commodity price inflation, except that that wave barely made a blip on this commodity super cycle chart. So I think that over the next 10 to 25 years, commodity prices are going to rise very sharply. And I think that even beyond this 150-year history, we have, again, consistent with this, with the change of the governance model, we are moving from the model that was dictated by Western powers, which included demand destruction, which pretty much kept commodity prices artificially low because Western colonial powers tended to deliberately keep commodity producing countries impoverished so that they could not develop industries domestically, so that they would not absorb their production of commodities and resources at home, so that, you know, Western corporations didn't have a competitor, so they could simply buy these commodities cheaply. China is seemingly pursuing a very different approach. Namely, they have positioned themselves as the global manufacturing hub, and they want the, you know, the billions of people in the world to be sufficiently affluent to be able to afford their products. So they want domestic economies around the world to flourish and to be becoming more prosperous. And I think as a consequence, commodity prices might rise beyond let's say historical norm, right?
Yep.
So going back to your question, I think that the probably what investors should consider strongly is to try to gain meaningful exposure to commodity prices. And I think that during the period of inflation, the objectives should be wealth preservation, to preserve as much purchasing power as possible, because what usually happens when the inflationary cycle unwinds completely that equity prices become dirt cheap. So for all investors who manage to preserve the purchasing power of their wealth, then they face a buyer's market in equity markets. And just, you know, to give you a specific concrete example, when the Weimar Republic had its inflation 100 years ago in the 1921, at the end of that cycle, you would be able to buy the whole of Mercedes-Benz corporations for the price equivalent that was that amounted to 327 of their cars.
Wow.
And I don't know this, but I would guess that they must have had that many cars on their production lot and in their dealerships. So, you know, basically you would have been able to acquire that company for nothing. You know, and also, you know, real estate, 6-bedroom houses on the outskirts of Berlin could be bought for $100 at the end of Weimar inflation. So that's the kind of buyer's market that we might be able to take advantage of at the end of the inflationary period. But until then, I think that the best way to preserve purchasing power is through exposure to commodity prices. You know, obviously gold and silver are part of that, but it's you know, gold and silver are part of the commodity basket, but you also probably want exposure to some industrial metals, to energy, crude oil, natural gas, to agricultural commodities and so forth. And then, you know, strategy wise, you know, we don't know, we can't predict these events. And I don't know, the only way I know how to navigate these events is through systematic trend following.
So it sounds like being in physical things as the system's moving to or transitioning to a new system is going to create a great off-ramp from this Western colonial system that's kind of dying into whatever the newer system is going to be, because you see the rise of the BRICS nations. Their GDP is now higher than, what is it, the G7 nations. It's all physical, and it's this fire economy, this in the West, sort of the financial, insurance, real estate kind of thing, is now transitioning to more like more physical things and physical commodity things that people that actually needs, right? So the financialization kind of world is fading, and it's going to move into a world where real things are going to need to be produced, and real things or physical things are going to be valued, right?
Yes, exactly. I entirely agree with that. And if you look at the case of the United States, you can see that even in the United States over the last 3 or 4 years, the manufacturing has begun to pick up, and service sector of the economy has begun to decline. And I think that's just the beginning of that wave. But yeah. I believe these are all positive. These are all positive developments, because the fire sector, as you said, is basically, you know, a large wealth vacuum cleaner that's, you know, taking wealth from those who produce it and into the people who control the financial matrix. And so I think I kind of regard all these developments as positives. But it will be a transition. It probably will be bumpy, and it, you know, for some people, it'll be difficult to get through this transition period.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then from a counterparty risk standpoint, that's what we always talk about too. It's very important to have that in your strategy, right? Because who holds your investments, or who your investments with, and so forth in this transition, as it gets a little bit bumpy, is pretty important.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. And I think that at the moment, the financial industry is not providing a good service to their investor. You know, they are still completely entrenched in long stocks and bonds, very crude investment strategies, you know, like 60-40, or, you know, like gauging your risk according to your age, whether you're retired, whether you're at the beginning of your career. It's all, you know, it's, I think this may have served investor well over the last 40 years of expanding money aggregates and the, you know, gradually declining interest rates. You know, like that's the environment we all knew for the last 40 years. And this is the environment which has formed the thinking. But we need to get past this thinking because we're not in that environment anymore. And that same thinking will get us into trouble. So it's time to, you know, it's time to for people to rethink their risks, to rethink their you know, objectives in managing their investments, and to consider certain alternatives that maybe, you know, you need to have the determination to rise up a new learning curve, you know. But, you know, that's what we have to do because that's the circumstances now.
I want to take a moment to recognize one of our sponsors. My friend Dave Zook says, you can be conventional or you can be wealthy. Pick one. At The Real Asset Investor, Dave and his team bring their investors high-yield investment opportunities across several asset classes for cash flow, tax impact, and equity growth. He and his team are one of the top five ATM operators in the country, and they have an investment opportunity available to accredited investors right now in the ATM space. To learn more about their ATM funds that produce tax-free cash flow, visit therealassetinvestor.com. That's therealassetinvestor.com. Yeah, one more question just on the investment side of it too. If you look at that FIRE economy too, the really, if you look at it as a bubble, the air that's going into that FIRE economy is the debt, right? Which is the debt-based monetary system. Which that's, as you know, if you look at all these systems that we just mentioned, they're all at the end, right? I mean, they're literally, I mean, I know people have been talking about this for quite a while and asking how long can this continue, but you're looking at it now, you're going, I mean, here in the United States, what is it, $32 trillion? And that is just, we're not even including all the other promises that they made over here that, as far as Social Security and, you know, the entitlement programs and so forth. And it's like that all over the world. So you're at the end of that system, seemingly, too.
You are. And I think that there are even problems that we are not well aware of yet, because, you know, as the Western powers are losing control of the Eurasian landmass, you know, the Eurasian continent, the Middle East, the South American nations, that represents the huge chunk of the collateral of the Western financial system. When you knock out that collateral, then all those debts that have been feeding the FIRE sector become bad debts. You know, it's without collateral, those debts are not worth very much. So it becomes printed money. And I think we're on a downward trajectory. And that downward trajectory obviously doesn't go in a straight line. But what it does, it goes gradually down. You know, people get kind of used to it. It's okay. It's not so bad. But then you have these very sharp turns when something really bad happens, and then, you know, we have a new crisis on our hand. And I think that, you know, these events are going to be taking markets by surprise, because they obviously always do, you know, and when financial crisis hit the East Asian economies, it was like a bolt of lightning from the clear blue skies. And I think we're going to have many more such risk events over the next, you know, decade or two decades even. But I think that at the same time, we shouldn't overlook the fact that there's a reaction, and that there are, you know, individuals, entrepreneurs, businesses, companies who are investing and developing real economy, producing real goods, and plugging it back into this global exchange mechanism that is being developed. And I think that one day we're going to be in a healthy upward trajectory. Only the transition is going to be probably a little bit uncomfortable.
Yes, it's going to be messy, but like we've always said, that there's going to be so much opportunities that this brings, yes. Right? So that's what folks should be, relishing, because there will be plenty of opportunities. And we talk a lot about, you know, we talk about business, we talk about investments, we talk about cash flow, money, and so forth. But we also talk a little bit about legacy. So I always ask my first time guests on the show if they cannot leave money to future generations, but we're only allowed to pass on to them like three principles or values to help them achieve happiness and success. What would they be? What would you share with regards to passing down some principles?
That's excellent. But if you limit me to three, that's hard. Well, I would say, always tell the truth, number one. Number two, work on yourself, cultivate knowledge and skills. And I guess also cultivate resilience. And if I could use a metaphor, I would say to a young person, think of yourself as a seedling. Your job is to grow strong, stable, and resilient. So the work you have to do is to push your roots as deep and as far as you can, to explore fertile terrains, to explore nutrients in terms of, you know, like knowledge and skills, which you know could become the nutrients of you developing your life.
Yep.
And to be very patient with yourself and to be ready to persevere, because you know, outside of the matrix, life can be extraordinarily rich and varied, but it doesn't include also necessarily the regular monthly, you know, compensation package and a bonus, yep, at the end of the year. And maybe it's not as predictable as the life in the matrix. But you know, if you have, if you're able to navigate that, if you have a certain degree of resilience and perseverance, then you know, like life can be so full of magic. So just like work on yourself, invest in yourself, develop yourself, and always tell the truth, because when the minute you don't, you start slip sliding to where you don't want to go. And so it's just better not to even start.
Those are great. I love the resilience part and the perseverance, because the message is perfect right now, because during these times, you need to be resilient and persevere.
Yes. Yes.
Alex, this has been a blast. Where can people follow you? Where can they subscribe to your newsletter, your Substack, and where can they stay informed of all the many projects that you're involved with?
Oh, so I have a website which is called iSystem Trend Following, iSystem-TF.com. I'm very easy to find on Twitter, which is my handle is @NakedHedgie, and I also write on Substack. My newsletter is Alex Craner's Trend Compass. And so from there, I'm pretty easy to find.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you so much for sharing your journey and your knowledge and just providing so much valuable for all of my listeners and viewers.
Thank you, MC. I appreciate you having me. It's a privilege, and warm greetings from Croatia to all your listeners and viewers.
And thank you to you, the listeners and viewers, for spending the most valuable resource, your time, once again with me on the show. Everything Cashflow Ninja is at cashflowninja.com, cashflowninja.com. Until next time, live infinitely.
This presentation is for educational and informational purposes only. The information being presented and considered does not consider your particular financial objectives or situation, and it does not make personalized recommendations. This material is not intended to replace the advice of a qualified tax and legal advisor or other qualified professionals, and you should not use the information in place of a customized consultation with a licensed professional regarding your specific personal financial objectives, situation, and needs. We believe the information provided is reliable, but we do not guarantee its accuracy, timeliness, or completeness.